seismic news in Washington. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announces a formal impeachment inquiry of President Trump.
The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
Trump tweets back, presidential harassment, witch hunt. Also, the Saudis host an event on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, but had trouble finding a venue.
Even though the Saudi dictatorship still technically had an event in New York, it was an event that was a far cry from what they intended.
Plus, a U.S. government official broke rank and tipped off a New York Times reporter in Egypt.
If he did not pass it on in a timely fashion, something could happen to me that the paper would not want.
The paper is asking, does the White House stand behind the American press? I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. House Democrats have been pushing for it for months. And today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced a formal impeachment inquiry of President Trump.
I'm directing our six committees to proceed with their investigations under that umbrella of impeachment inquiry. The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
At issue are allegations that Trump pressured the president of Ukraine to launch an investigation into former vice president and now presidential candidate Joe Biden. The World's Matthew Bell is with me in the studio. Matthew, why now? Why did Pelosi take this step today?
So for many months, there were House Democrats, as you said, that were in favor of launching an impeachment inquiry. But just over the last day or so, as the details on this Ukraine story have come out, we just saw the number just going up and up, and more House Democrats became convinced that these were allegations that that Congress needs to look into. And as you mentioned, it's the crux of the allegations are that Donald Trump tried to use leverage of U.S. military aid to the government of Ukraine to get the president of Ukraine to dig up political dirt on Joe Biden. So even Nancy Pelosi herself for a long time was against going down the impeachment road, but she's come around to this now and made that announcement earlier.
What's the response been from President Trump?
President Trump pretty quickly was responding on Twitter. He called this presidential harassment. He said that the Democrats in the House are launching a witch hunt. He said that they haven't even seen the transcript of the phone call. That's a reference to a phone call that President Trump made to President Zelensky in Ukraine, where allegedly promises might have been made here.
And finally, what does it mean to launch a formal impeachment inquiry?
So that's complicated, and Pelosi said that this would involve multiple six committees in the House. Remember, it's an inquiry. It's an investigation. It's not, you know, impeachment itself. Throwing the president out is far down the road, and that would involve moving to the Senate. It would bring in the Supreme Court. Even that's a much bigger thing. But right now, this is all playing out. Interestingly, it's playing out as President Trump has been attending the UN General Assembly in New York, meeting with world leaders, including President Zelensky. He's got a meeting with tomorrow.
And we'll get into more of the legal and procedural side of impeachment proceedings with Margaret Taylor, senior editor at Lawfare, later in the show. But I want to thank The World's Matthew Bell for being with me.
Thank you.
Meantime, President Trump was in New York today for day two of the UN General Assembly. Every leader is officially given 15 minutes to offer their take on world affairs, and it started with Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro said any initiative to support the Amazon must fully respect Brazilian sovereignty. The World's Carolyn Beeler and Maria Elena Romero are at the UN. Let's start with you, Carolyn, and the Brazilian president's speech.
He dedicated a significant chunk of his speech to the Amazon. He roundly criticized what he called sensationalist attacks from the international media about his handling of those Amazon fires. And he said that offers of help from the G7 were a threat to Brazil's sovereignty. And he also tried to sell Brazil's environmental record, highlighting the vast swaths of undeveloped forest that the country still has.
My administration has solemnly committed itself to environmental preservation and to sustainable development. Our Amazonian region is larger than all of Western Europe and remains virtually pristine and untouched, which is evidence of the fact that we are one of the countries that most protect the environment.
A lofty statement there. He also went on to blame dry weather and high winds for, he called them, spontaneous wildfires, and emphasized that burning to clear land is part of both indigenous and local cultures in Brazil.
Did anybody fact check those things? I mean, was high winds and dry weather part of the reason for the wildfires? And how about the indigenous and local culture around burning?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's true that a pretty high percentage of Brazil is still, in fact, covered with its native vegetation. More than 60% are still forest or savanna or scrubland. It's not true that dry weather and high winds are to blame for any significant number of fires in the Amazon. It's a humid rainforest. It doesn't have the same patterns of natural fire and regrowth that some of the forests in the U.S. have, for example. So it's also true that burning land to clear for agriculture has been going on for a long time in Brazil, but it's also true that those fires have increased this past year under Bolsonaro and his policies. But, you know, his environmental argument was mostly underpinned, you know, not by science, but by the idea that the Amazon is Brazil's and not anyone else's.
It is a fallacy to say that the Amazon is the heritage of humankind, and a misconception as confirmed by scientists to say that our Amazonian forests are the lungs of the world. Using and resorting to these fallacies, certain countries, instead of helping, called into question that which we hold as the most sacred value, our sovereignty.
He also spent several minutes of his speech trying to burnish his image as an ally of indigenous Brazilians, even reading a letter of support from them on stage. Our colleague Maria Elena Romero here has been reporting on that.
Hello, Carol.
Hey, Maria Elena. Now, Jair Bolsonaro's government, I don't think it's ever been very popular with indigenous leaders. How does his speech today fit into the larger picture?
That's right. Bolsonaro has been criticized for his treatment of indigenous people. And today at the UNGA, he used his speech to defend his policies. He said that indigenous communities are thirsty and eager to see development and to have access to health and education. He said that he will not expand land set aside for indigenous people, and he will open some of these lands for mining, which will translate into economic development for those communities.
But I understand Bolsonaro traveled to the UN with an indigenous leader who does support him. How's that gone over?
Right. Traveling with Brazil's official delegation is an indigenous woman called Isani Kalapalo. She was in the hall watching the speech as it happened, listening to Bolsonaro. She's from an indigenous village in the state of Mato Grosso in central Brazil, and she's a rare pro-Bolsonaro voice, indigenous voice. She's an outspoken supporter of his policies, and she speaks about the need for economic development in indigenous lands. About a week ago, she appeared on a video posted on Brazil's foreign ministry's YouTube page.
O que ele está dizendo aqui é muito importante porque
saying that there were lots of fake news circulating in the media about the Amazon fires.
What is Kalapalo's reputation among other indigenous leaders? Does she have a lot of support?
Having Kalapalo as part of Brazil's official delegation to the UNGA actually prompted a strongly worded letter from indigenous leaders in Brazil. They denounced Bolsonaro's policies, and they also denounced the presence of Kalapalo here as a representative of indigenous people. I spoke to Dina Mantusha, who is part of a political and advocacy organization that represents over 300 indigenous groups in Brazil.
E a Insane Kalapalo, ela não representa os povos indígenas.
He says that Kalapalo does not represent indigenous Brazilians, and that the fact that Bolsonaro is portraying her as such is just another manifestation of his authoritarian policies.
The World's Carolyn Beeler and Maria Elena Romero at the United Nations. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
There are lots of side events taking place outside UN headquarters. One of them was the Youth Summit, sponsored by the MISC Foundation, founded by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. According to a special UN report, there's credible evidence the Crown Prince was responsible for the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. And as the world's Shirin Jafari reports from New York, the Youth Summit has turned into one of the most controversial side events so far.
The event was so secret that the organizers didn't even tell me where it was taking place. Maybe because they'd learned their lesson. Earlier this month, when they announced the New York Public Library as the venue, human rights activists were up in arms. 7,500 people signed a petition pressuring the library to drop the event. The activists got their wish. The library canceled, and some of the speakers dropped out. On Monday, just a few hours before the Youth Forum was about to start at a new location, I finally got an email. with an address. Broadway, two blocks from the World Trade Center, steps from the 9/11 memorial. Inside the venue, about 200 people, mostly young and very stylish, stood chatting away. The youth forum was originally scheduled to be co-hosted by the UN's youth envoy, but she also dropped out at the last minute. The description for the forum included buzzwords like entrepreneurship, empowerment, sustainable development.
So I'm here representing my organization and also as an individual myself.
Omitoko Abolaji is from Nigeria, but has been living in Washington, D.C. since January.
Back home in Nigeria, I work with young entrepreneurs, including agriculture, tech.
His goal, he says, is to connect with other entrepreneurs, learn new ideas, and to take those ideas back home. But this Saudi-sponsored forum is taking place just days before the anniversary of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And the CIA and UN officials have concluded that high-ranking members of the Saudi government were responsible for his death. So I ask Abolaji about concerns that the Saudi government is using events like this one, sponsored by the Crown Prince's personal charity, to deflect attention.
There's no perfect country and there's no perfect system. So we have to be accommodating and tolerant.
One thing is clear about the MISC Foundation. It has money to put on a big show.
Please help me welcome actor, musician, entrepreneur, and UN Environment Goodwill Ambassador, Adrien Grenier.
Actor Adrien Grenier showed up promoting his ocean conservation initiative, Lonely Whale.
Inspired by a real whale who's struggling to communicate with other whales of his kind.
Business leaders from France, Brazil, and Canada also gave presentations. Agnes Calamar, the UN expert who investigated the murder of Khashoggi, says she's concerned that for some people, it's business as usual when it comes to dealing with Saudi Arabia.
The lack of commitment to hold Saudi Arabia to account, coupled with the commitment to continue political and a financial relationship with Saudi Arabia is sending an extremely wrong message. That message is, if you have the financial might, then you can do more or less whatever you want.
For Shaima Hamid-Din, executive manager of the MISC Global Forum, yesterday's event was a big success.
Nothing stands in our way when it comes to youth empowerment. Like any initiative, we come across challenges. We always find a way to overcome these challenges and make sure we're serving.
But does she understand the concerns raised by Calamar and other human rights advocates?
Honestly, I don't quite understand, because we're doing so much good. We've impacted 900,000 young people.
She goes on to list all the different initiatives the foundation is involved in. But Sanjeev Berry also views the event as a success.
This is an important moment for us.
Berry is with Freedom Forward, the group that started the petition that led to the cancellation of the event at the New York Public Library.
Even though the Saudi dictatorship still technically had an event in New York, it was an event that was a far cry from what they intended. Multiple speakers dropped out, and they were even dropped by the United Nations itself.
Berry and Calamar say they will continue their efforts to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for human rights violations, at a time when some celebrities, influential figures, and governments have decided to look the other way. For The World, Shirin Jafari, New York.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. In Egypt, we're seeing a rare display of dissent. In recent days, sporadic protests have broken out in Egyptian cities, including Cairo's Tahrir Square, calling on President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to step down. On the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, President Trump met with Egypt's authoritarian leader on Monday. Trump told reporters the anti-Sisi protests are not cause for concern.
Egypt has a great leader. He's highly respected. He's brought order. Before he was here, there was very little order. There was chaos. And so I'm not worried about that.
Trump isn't just saying great things about Egypt's leader. He's also helping him squelch dissent. This week, the New York Times revealed that Egypt's government had planned to arrest its reporter, Declan Walsh, in 2017. White House officials didn't take the journalist's side. Declan Walsh says at the time, Egypt's government was angry with him for writing a story about an Italian graduate student who disappeared in Cairo.
His body had been found on the side of a road in Cairo with signs of extensive torture. So the New York Times magazine published a long piece about that case. And within that story, there were some voices from American officials who were also pointing the finger towards Egypt.
And then your editors at the Times get a call from a U.S. official. What does the official say?
The official tells them that the U.S. government has information that the Egyptians were furious about the article and that some people inside the Egyptian system were mulling very serious action against me, up to and including arrest.
So who was the person who called the Times about your situation?
For security reasons and for source protection reasons, all I can say is that the tip-off came from someone within the Trump administration who's in Washington.
And that person passed along the information that your arrest could be imminent.
That's right.
It's a disturbing thing to hear, but that sort of warning itself isn't that unusual. I mean, news outlets frequently get tipped off about threats to their reporters working in authoritarian countries. The unusual part of the call is what the official said about why he or she got in touch with the Times.
That's right. So this person was, I think, taking considerable professional risk, at least, by making the call to the newspaper. Usually these calls, when they come through, or when they've come through in the past, they come through semi-official channels. An official will call the paper to pass on this kind of information with the say-so of that person's superiors. But in this case, this official was acting on their own initiative. They felt that the Trump administration had this information but was not likely to act on it. And therefore, if an arrest was to take place, that the administration was not going to intervene before that happened. This contrasts with how the U.S. government has behaved in the past. I had an experience some years ago when I was based in Pakistan, and ultimately I was expelled from the country in 2013. But before that, I had received warnings from American officials about my security in Pakistan at that time, and they came through the more traditional channels where American officials passed on that information with the say-so of their superiors. So this was certainly a different situation.
Now, Declan, you did manage to slip out of Egypt in 2017 without being arrested. How did you do that?
After we got this warning, I called the American embassy for advice or help. The officials there were sympathetic, but they said that as an Irish citizen, I should really take my case to the Irish embassy, which is what I did. The Irish immediately sent around a car and a diplomat who accompanied me to the airport immediately. And then they waited with me while I booked a flight, and I took the first available flight to Europe.
Now, it's 2019, and though you're in London speaking to me, you are bureau chief for The New York Times in Cairo. Have you gotten any kind of anything happened that suggests that the Egyptian government isn't happy with you since then?
There's been plenty of signs that the Egyptian government has been unhappy with my reporting. They complain directly to me, just as they do to many other foreign correspondents in Egypt. There are stories sort of attacking me occasionally in the local press after I write about certain subjects. And there was an incident last year where an Egyptian news website translated a story that I had co-authored about vote rigging during the presidential elections in Egypt. And that website was subsequently, its offices were closed down by the authorities. And the editor of that website was prosecuted. He was charged effectively with Egypt's version of fake news. And he's currently being held at a prison outside Cairo.
What's your takeaway from this whole episode?
Large American newspapers for a long time, and this is a point that our publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, made in an article that was published in the paper today. Large American papers worked on an assumption that in extreme cases, in difficult countries like Egypt, the paper and papers like it could rely on the U.S. government to step in and help if a reporter faced deportation or arrest or something more serious. And with the sort of rhetoric that has come out of the Trump administration, where the president is frequently being referring to the press as the enemies of the people, and with the staunch support that the administration has offered to authoritarian leaders like Mr. Sisi, often unquestioning support, at least in public, there's a sense that that assumption that the U.S. government will always step in is, I wouldn't say that it no longer holds true, but I would say that it is no longer as solid as it once was.
Declan Walsh is a New York Times correspondent. Egypt's government had planned to arrest him in 2017. White House officials didn't take the journalist's side. Thanks a lot, Declan.
Thank you.
Imagine you're cooking. You have what you think is some random decorative art above the stove. Then an art historian weighs in.
Few discoveries in the art history world, I think, are seriously important. And I think this is one.
Xavier Solomon is the chief curator at the Frick Collection in New York. The painting, which hung for years above a hot plate in northern France, depicts a Christ-like figure cloaked in dark robes. He's surrounded by a group of men who look like they're pestering him. A few have swords. It was done by Cimabue, a 13th century Italian painter. That's an almost mythical name among art historians. Solomon says Cimabue was responsible for a significant shift in the way art was made at the time.
So from a medieval way of representing the world to a more modern way as we see it today. So in that respect, he's the father of modern painting.
A work by the father of modern painting is extremely rare. Only about 10 pieces that exist today can be attributed to Cimabue. This new one, a wooden panel called Christ Mocked, is believed to be part of a series of 8 related scenes. 2 were discovered before the one hanging in the French kitchen. Those first 2 are housed in the National Gallery in London and in the Frick Collection. With the newest addition, art historians are closer to putting the whole puzzle together.
So this one that just came up in France should be below the National Gallery one and to the left of our one at the Frick, which seems to make sense.
And when Christ Mocked goes to auction next month, let's just say it's expected to fetch a pretty penny.
I would guess a significant amount of money. It could be a record breaker. There hasn't been a Cimabue on the market in known history. So it could break all records for paintings of that period and that type.
So next time you're standing at the stove, look up.
There are still 5 pieces out there waiting to be found.
One could be in your kitchen. To see what the painting looks like, check out our Instagram at PRI The World. Pop quiz. What's the first element on the periodic table? You may know that thanks to a Russian chemist who devised the periodic table.
He saw how literally all the building blocks of the world should come together, wrote it down, and it's proved correct.
The periodic table turns 150. That's coming up on The World. Also, the answer is hydrogen. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. A political earthquake in Washington today. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry. I'm directing our 6 committees to proceed with their investigations under that umbrella of impeachment inquiry. The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
Matthew Bell is with me in the studio, and here to help us understand what Speaker Pelosi has announced is Margaret Taylor. She's a senior editor and counsel at Lawfare and a fellow in government studies at the Brookings Institution. Margaret, why did Representative Pelosi make this move today?
Well, she has been under a fair amount of pressure from certain members of the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives to move in this direction. She has been resisting it for months and months. What changed last night and this morning was that a number of freshman Democrats, so people who were just elected for the first time last year, who were coming from red states, they had flipped their seats, some of them, and they essentially came out with an op-ed and told Nancy Pelosi that they were comfortable with moving forward on impeachment. And I think Nancy Pelosi was hearing from her caucus, including those important freshman Democrats, about the gravity of the situation. I think Nancy Pelosi agrees with the gravity of the situation and the facts as they have unfolded over the past few weeks with respect to the president's conduct with the president of Ukraine. And so this reached a breaking point. The dam is sort of broken, and now she is throwing her weight behind an official impeachment inquiry.
And now, Margaret, that we hear that this decision has been made, Pelosi said 6 committees will be looking into this. Give us a sense of – this sounds complicated. Give us a sense of the nuts and bolts of how does an impeachment inquiry actually work?
So what's really interesting to me about this announcement is that it's really Nancy Pelosi throwing her weight behind something that is sort of already set up procedurally. To understand it a little bit better, you have to go back a few months when Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, actually announced that his committee was engaged already in an impeachment investigation. And there was speculation that he did that in order to aid in some litigation that he was pursuing in connection with obtaining the testimony of former White House counsel Don McGahn. So the chairman of the Judiciary Committee has already announced and has been saying for weeks now that he is in an impeachment investigation. And it was always a little bit unclear where Nancy Pelosi was on that. As part of that, Nadler essentially, you know, he passed a resolution through his committee a couple of weeks ago that expanded the powers of the committee a little bit more to try to, you know, ease the way information is collected for impeachment. So now what it seems she is doing is essentially putting various efforts of different committees under that existing umbrella and throwing her weight behind it. In terms of nuts and bolts, I don't think we know exactly how it's going to work out. But what we know is that what it seems that those particular committees, which is the Oversight Committee, the Intelligence Committee, the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Financial Services Committee, and the Ways and Means Committee, are going to be sending information to the Judiciary Committee. And they may even hold hearings and interview witnesses in those committees with the powers of the Judiciary Committee. So, but we don't know exactly how it's going to work out in terms of nuts and bolts because she didn't address that.
And when we look at the Mueller investigation, it went on for 2 years. What are we talking about here? This is something we're now looking at the election a year or so out. How long would something like this go on for?
So you have put your finger on a really key question, which is what is the time frame that she has in mind? She did not make a statement about what the time frame might be. And so the substantive question is, you know, what will these committees do if the executive branch and the president continue to stonewall on providing information to these committees? That has been how the executive branch and the president have been treating these committees all along. So what will these committees do if that continues? As we sit here right now, it is not clear what the time frame would be because she didn't put a time frame around it.
Margaret Taylor is a senior editor and counsel at Lawfare and a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Thanks a lot, Margaret.
Thank you.
As we just heard, Ukraine and allegations of corruption are at the center of this latest scandal in Washington. Valeria Gontareva was the governor of Ukraine's central bank from 2014 to 2018. Now she lives in the UK and works at the London School of Economics. I asked her what type of corruption was going on when she first became the head of Ukraine's central bank.
We are not just talking about corruption. You know, corruption is when state bodies do something wrong. But unfortunately, all Ukrainian banking system was in the hands of oligarchs. And that's why it was absolutely perverting Ukrainian banking system. It was like an oligarch-owned banking system. But oligarchs never use banking system for real banking. They always use banking system only in their favor. It was like just a vested interest of oligarchs. And for example, this biggest bank, which was nationalized, it was just like a Ponzi scheme. It was like a pyramid.
Valeria, you seem to have paid dearly for fighting corruption in Ukraine. I know you're in London, but tell us what's happened to you and your family over the past several weeks.
First of all, the car of my son was torched. It was burned completely. It was 5th of September. After a few days, 12.
And that was in Ukraine?
Yes, it was in Kiev, in the center of city, during the night time. And after 12th of September, some unknown 10 people in black masks with machine guns intruded to my apartment. But the final stage of all this awful stuff was night 17th of September, when my family lived, it was completely burned to ash. My family is absolutely shocked.
And you feel like these things that have happened in Ukraine are all related to the steps you took to clean up the banking system,
no doubt,
to nationalize a bank.
I had numerous, during 5 years, all these oligarchs threatened me and also created absolutely incredible evil slander campaign against me.
I want to get back to Ukraine President Zelensky. He campaigned on the promise to fight corruption. What has he done on that score?
You know, it's very difficult to blame right now the new president because all these wrongdoings based on absolutely corrupted general prosecutor office together with police and all this court system. I could not tell you that Zelensky could change all of that during 3 months when he was elected like a president. That's why, you know, of course, I'd like to see that Zelensky move to right direction. I could not tell you that it's the case right now.
Just today, President Zelensky signed a bill creating a procedure to impeach a sitting president in Ukraine like himself. Is this a promising step, in your opinion?
These people, it's a very good artist and comedians, you know. We'd like to see the real stuff, not just when somebody show you some smoky screen to hide all wrongdoings behind, you know. Let's hope they will start the real reform of our court system. Let's hope that it will be changed somehow. And I know that all international community right now press Zelensky to be somehow reasonable and do all the right things. Because it's not just fighting corruption. Fighting corruption, it's a very nice, good slogan, but we need to do real reform. Like we did reform in financial sector and banking sector, transformation of central bank, or in Ministry of Finance. He needs immediately to start the reform in judicial system, court system, general prosecutor office, and all this. Unfortunately, it was not yet done. That's why all these oligarchs could rely on absolutely corrupted system of prosecution in our country.
Valeria, the U.S. supported your work in 2014 and your work to really rid the banking system of corruption. I wonder, does it bother you that big companies in Ukraine still have arrangements like having, you know, American citizens on their board, like Hunter Biden? I mean, is that still just the way things are done?
You know, I could not tell you that it's some bad science for me that someone professional, for example, sitting in a board. For example, when we invited new supervisory board of PrivatBank, we invited all very professional bankers around the globe to be a member of supervisory board. It means that if you're professional in this particular field, if you're American or if you're European or if you are even from China, if you're a professional banker with your good background, I think it's a good idea to be independent boards even of Ukrainian state companies. That's why I'm not talking about, you know, son of vice president.
Hunter Biden.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about corporate governance, new standards, and professional people. I'd like and I invite all professional people to join state companies in Ukraine. I think it's a very good sign for us. Not any more corruption, but the real professional people sitting in boards.
Valeria Gontareva was the governor of Ukraine's central bank from 2014 to 2018. She's been speaking to us from London. Thanks a lot, Valeria.
Yes, thank you, Carol. Yeah, bye.
In Europe, they have this thing called the right to be forgotten. Online, that is, Europeans can have certain information wiped from the internet. Things like results about them on Google and other search engines. But that right only goes so far. Geographically, at least. Today, Europe's highest court issued a decision saying that Google doesn't have to apply European rules globally. The World's Lydia Amanalidou is in the studio to explain. Lydia, first remind us what the right to be forgotten law is all about.
Yeah, so in the European Union, as you said, Carol, they have this right to be forgotten law. And the way it applies to Google and other search engines is if you search your name, so you search Carol Hills, and you get results with information that might be old, irrelevant, inaccurate, you can reach out to Google and ask them to take it down. So it doesn't mean they delete the information. It just means they take it off their search results. And this is a right that people have had since 2014 in Europe to request that this sort of information be delisted.
So it works if I am in a European Union country, I can ask Google to get rid of certain things, or they're not getting rid of it, but they're just removing it from the search results.
Exactly. And so what today's ruling had to do with, it was all about this dispute that began a few years ago in 2015 between Google and this European privacy watchdog. And this watchdog was arguing that if someone in France, for example, has something removed from Google, that those same amended search results show up when someone searches that French person's name inside the European Union where the laws apply, as well as outside the European Union. Google was opposed to this. They didn't want those same amended search results to show up everywhere. And one of their arguments was, think about how an authoritarian regime might abuse this and censor things that, you know, embarrass their politicians or leaders. So this case went all the way up to the European Court of Justice, the EU's highest court. And earlier today, the court issued a decision siding with Google and saying essentially no, that Google and other search engines don't have to apply the right to be forgotten law outside of Europe.
Wow. So this is a victory for Google. I mean, practically, what does it mean for people in Europe and the US?
Practically, what it means is that two people could be searching for the same thing, the same name, but they could be seeing very different results based on where they are. So if you're within the European Union, you would be seeing one thing. And if you're in the US, you would be seeing another thing.
So say I have a friend in Italy. They go through the procedures and have Google no longer show certain results in if somebody Google searches their name in Italy. But they could call me on the phone and I could look up their name. And the old stuff that they had asked Google to remove in Europe, I could see it.
That's right. And even if you're within the EU, we should say there are ways to get around this and use, for example, a virtual private network and make it seem like you are somewhere else and, you know, be able to access the same results. But it's really interesting because here in the US, we don't really have anything comparable to the right to be forgotten law. And over the past few years, we've seen Europe implement a lot more privacy regulations that affect platforms that people use globally. And so inevitably, laws in one country might start affecting how users use a platform in another country. Today, we saw the European Justice Court say, no, this particular privacy law can only be applied within the European Union.
The world's Lydia Amanalidou. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
It's Oktoberfest time in Munich. That means Lederhosen, tourists, and beer. Lots of beer. And if you spend an evening indulging, there's a chance you could wake up like this.
You okay, buddy?
No, I'm in so much pain right now.
Like the characters in the film The Hangover, you could wake up with nausea, a headache, and dry mouth. So what can you do about it? Drinking lots of water helps. Some swear by caffeine or greasy food. Then there's a German drink called 147. The company behind it claims it could help. In fact, right there in big letters on the label, it says anti-hangover drink. It sounds too good to be true, and now a court in Frankfurt has confirmed it is too good to be true. The company was sued because the drink claimed it could prevent and cure an illness. That's right, in Germany, a hangover is now officially an illness, and it's illegal to market food and drink as an antidote to illnesses, which means the crew at 147 is going to have to pivot their marketing strategy. They're going to keep selling their drink, they just can't call it a cure for a hangover. In other words, people can still buy it, but there's no guarantee it will work. For partygoers in Munich, things could be worse. There could be a tiger in the bathroom.
What's going on?
There's a jungle cat in the bathroom!
Okay!
You're with the world. Tunisia is a tourist paradise. Ancient ruins, golden beaches, and cosmopolitan cities. It's one of Africa's most popular destinations. Or it was. 4 years ago, a gunman attacked a hotel resort there and killed 38 people, mostly British vacationers. Major European tour operators stayed away and only started returning last year. But as you heard on our program yesterday, the world's oldest travel agency, Thomas Cook, has gone belly up. Vacations for hundreds of thousands of Europeans were canceled. And the consequences were felt instantly in Tunisia. Wahida Jayet is director of the Tunisian National Tourism Board in London. Wahida, I've been reading about tourists being stranded in Tunisia. Do we know how many are kind of stuck there as they figure out how to get back home?
First of all, let me reassure you as far as this repatriation operation is concerned. Indeed, there's been a kind of issue in one hotel and only one hotel, let me make it clear, that is l'Hôtel des Orangers in Hammamet.
The issue in that particular case was that the guests at
only
one hotel.
Only in one hotel, yeah.
Only in
absolutely.
One hotel.
For the rest, it was okay.
Right.
It went
but
very
they were being,
smoothly.
But they were being asked by the hotel to pay these extra fees because they weren't going to get, the hotel wasn't going to be paid by Thomas Cook.
True. That happened for some of the cases out of the 14 clients, but things have been settled down on the spot. And all these clients managed to get back home very safely. And I think that was just a moment of panic that put, some of the staff shouldn't have done that. I'm not justifying. I'm not saying that was good, right?
So with the collapse of Thomas Cook, are you kind of back to square one with British tourists, or are there other companies that bring British tourists to Tunisia?
No, well, thanks God, there are other companies. But honestly, it is true that for the UK market, Thomas Cook is ranking number one. So the question is whether Thomas Cook is a big player. Yes, definitely. It was a big player on Tunisia, and we are losing definitely a lot. If I give you a comparison, it's 10,000 people, for example. France is sending 10,000 visitors with Thomas Cook from France, and it's a range of 140 targeted by Thomas Cook this year from UK. So you see the ranges, there is a huge discrepancy in terms of targets of customers to Tunisia, whether you are in UK or in France.
So you're losing lots of tourists, not just British, but French as well, through the collapse of Thomas Cook.
Yeah, we have about 3 million. We were expecting about 3 million from Europe this year, out of probably a total of reaching 9 million visitors worldwide. So for this year, it is true to say that Thomas Cook was, I have to speak in the past now, the most important player from the UK market as far as Tunisia is concerned.
Wahida, you head up a tourism board on Tunisia. You're based in London, but what's your favorite thing about the country?
My favorite thing about the country, something which is genuine, is the sense of hospitality and the generosity of people. You always have a very warm welcome. It's a small country where you can do lots of things. There is a lot to explore in my country.
Wahida Jayat is director of the Tunisian National Tourism Board in London. Wahida, thanks a lot.
You're most welcome, and hope to see you soon in Tunisia.
Climate change, Iran, religious freedom, democracy, trade, all were on display at the United Nations General Assembly today. The UN is also marking the 150th anniversary of the Periodic Table of Chemical Elements. You know the one. It kind of looks like a Scrabble board. From element 1, hydrogen, to element 118, organesson.
Europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
The United Nations General Assembly and UNESCO have declared 2019 the International Year of the Periodic Table. The BBC's Justin Rowlett has devoted an entire radio series to it. Justin, the periodic table was discovered by Russian chemist Dmitry Mendeleev. Who was he?
I mean, he was an extraordinary chemist. I mean, he kind of systematized all the fundamental building blocks of the world, the chemical elements, in a way that nobody else had before. It was a quite extraordinary step in chemistry. Other chemists had sensed that there were relationships between the various chemical elements they'd discovered, but no one had put them together quite the same way as he did. He organized them in those distinctive columns on the basis of their atomic weight and their chemical properties in a way that's stood firm ever since then, for 150 years, an extraordinary chemical achievement.
When Mendeleev created the table, there were 63 elements. Now there are 118. Is this table going to keep getting bigger and bigger?
It could get a bit bigger, but we think we're pretty near the end. I mean, what was extraordinary about what Mendeleev did was that he predicted missing elements. He created the structure and he said, there's probably an element here and it'll have these properties and this weight. There's another one here. And sure enough, in the years to come, people found those elements, a kind of ringing endorsement of the structure that he created for the elements.
Now, you've reported on many of the elements, where they come from, what their properties are, and how we use them.
Carol, all of the elements.
So what's your favorite element and why?
Well, it's really interesting. I was thinking about that. It's kind of like, you know, a chocolate box. They're all kind of crucial if you think about it like that. So I was thinking, I had a slightly different approach. I was thinking, which one did I have most fun? And I plumped for gold.
Oh.
Now, that sounds really, really obvious. Gold, obviously, the most alluring element of them all. But we asked a really interesting question with gold, which in a way throws light on the entire periodic table. We said, why is gold the most valuable element? And to guide us through the periodic table, we had this wonderful chemist, a guy called Professor Andrea Seller of University College London. And he helped me on this journey. I said, you know, why gold? He gestured immediately towards the right-hand side of the table. And he said, look, you could get rid of some elements very easily. All the gases go at once. You couldn't have a currency, which of course is the key purpose of gold over the years for humanity. Then obviously the two liquid elements, mercury and bromine. Then he looks at the left-hand side of the table. He says many of them are too reactive, so we're thinking kind of sodium, potassium. You don't want the radioactive ones because they're going to kill you. Not great. Then we've got the rare earths. I mean, they sound pretty promising. I mean, they're rare, which obviously is useful when you're thinking about a currency, except most of them are actually a lot less rare than gold. So that leaves us in the middle of the periodic table. 49 elements we've got here. Once again, we can rule loads of those out because they're either very hard to smelt. You need to get your furnace up to like 1,000 degrees centigrade.
You're being really pragmatic.
Yeah, exactly. And then on the other hand, loads of them corrode very easily. So we're left, you know, having gone through 118 elements, we started with a whole lot. We're just down to 8 contenders. Let me just quickly list them for you. Platinum, palladium, rhodium, iridium, osmium, ruthenium, and the two old familiars, gold and silver. And silver tarnishes.
Wow.
So what are you left with? You're left with gold. How persuasive of that? Of course it was gold. There was no choice. I bet you're wearing some gold now.
You know what? I'm not.
Well, get yourself some. You know, okay. It's a great investment in these troubled economic times. But, you know, there you go. That's the reason why we value it. That's the reason why wedding rings are made of it.
The BBC's Justin Rowlett. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thanks, Carol.
Gold and the 150th anniversary of the periodic table of chemical elements. That's where we leave things today. We'll be back tomorrow with global perspectives on today's major news from Washington. The impeachment word is out and the world reacts. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.